Christensen with, and he is being sponsored by Tanner Clinic. Can we have everybody from Tanner Clinic stand up and be recognized? Because these are our sponsors for the next talk. So Benjamin Christensen will be speaking on traumatic brain injury evaluation tools, rehab, and treatment.
All right. Well, it's a pleasure to be with you this morning. Like they said, I'm Dr. Chris Jansen. I'm the neuropsychologist at Tanner Clinic, and we've just barely began a traumatic brain injury clinic, so a brain injury clinic there at Tanner. So it's a pleasure to be here as we kind of go through. There's a lot of new information that's coming out. I'm not going to try to be your enemy and take too much of your breaks. We're going to try to go through it pretty quick, okay? I'm really quick because I'm a psychologist. Have to let you know I have no disclosures. I don't get paid for anything that I do outside of in my private practice. I'm quite a few affiliations. I stay pretty busy, but my wife still knows my name, so I'm doing okay with that. Really quick, traumatic brain injuries. You know, it's interesting because in my practice, we get quite a few individuals that come in that it seems that a lot of individuals don't appreciate what that is, either clinically or even our patients. We see it in parents, we see it in even in coaches. It just seems to be a pretty big misnomer. What we try to explain to people really easy is that a TBI occurs when there's a blow or a jolt or an acceleration or a deceleration of anything that impacts the brain. They don't have to lose consciousness to have a concussion or to have a traumatic brain injury. One of the important things that we're finding out, one of the things we find very important to share with people are what the demographics are so we can appreciate what might actually be going on. So we know that the number one cause of a traumatic brain injury are falls. But what we're starting to find out is about 21% of traumatic brain injuries are now coming from sports also. Motor vehicle accidents, struck by objects, and then assaults. And the risk factors are interesting because we see kind of both ends of the spectrum. Obviously, the younger the individual or the older, the higher the propensity for the fall. Gender, young males have a tendency to have more concussions. It's interesting, I was just at the World Congress on Brain Injuries, and they're sharing with us that young men seem to have more head injuries, but they also seem to be drunk outside of a bar at 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. in the morning. And all of us kind of sat there and smiled and went, I thought that was kind of knowledge that we all knew. But apparently in Norway, they spent a lot of money studying that. I guess that's what you do during the winter when there's no lights, you study people drunk. And then the lower the socioeconomic status, the higher propensity we're seeing for concussions. We think part of that has to do with just education, but also in sports, the ability to buy the proper equipment. I really want to share this one and kind of highlight it for a second, because this is something that the research is showing us that's really, really interesting when we have kiddos come in especially. Now this comes from the NCAA. I'm part of the Sports Neuropsychology Society, so I just came back from Cleveland where we were discussing this. And I want you to look at the color of the arrows and notice what's interesting here that we've not seen or not paid very good attention to. In soccer, women are almost twice as likely to have a sports-related brain injury than men. In lacrosse, they're about identical to men. And in basketball, they're almost double to men also. Now that's important because we have a tendency, sadly professionally, to not think of women as getting concussions as easily in sports. But what we're finding is they're actually more susceptible to injuries. At the bottom, just the most recent research that came out 3 days ago is that we're actually, what's interesting is in medicine, we've gotten better at saving lives from brain injuries. But ironically, the rate of traumatic brain injuries has more than doubled in the last decade in kids 19 years or younger. So while we're saving their lives in that immediate interaction, we're not really, really good at understanding what to do with them in the long run. I'm a brain nerd. If you walk into my office, all I've got are brains everywhere. Got little ones, big ones. I stole one out on one of the tables outside because I didn't have that color and I thought it looked good in my office. But what we want to appreciate, and the thing that's most important, is to understand what happens during the injury so we understand why the recovery is so important. So the number one way that we look at concussions or traumatic brain injuries is that it's an energy crisis. So if you think about what happens when we jump, we expend energy and it takes a second for the body to get prepared to fire again. Well, when we have a brain injury, it so disorients the calcium and potassium in the neuron that it actually takes even longer for it to fire. So when patients come in and say, I'm not thinking as fast as I used to, things just aren't coming as fast as I wanted them to, it's because their neurons actually aren't firing at the same speed. Now that's really important because if we put them back out on the field to play, they're going to be slower, they're going to react slower, they're going to do things in life slower, which actually increases the propensity for greater injuries because they're not functioning at the same level they have been training their whole life for. Now, this is really interesting because a lot of people in the field have seen this before. This comes from McCrea and his team. And this is what happens in the neurotransmitters in immediate concussion. So we see that increase of calcium, potassium spikes, cerebral blood flow diminishes, all these things occur. But the important part for us isn't just that piece. We all kind of know that. That's the first 24 to 48 hours where they just don't feel good. What research does show us, however, is that oftentimes as medical professionals, because they don't show signs immediately, we assume that nothing's occurred. Research is now showing us that many of the symptoms of traumatic brain injuries don't even begin to show up till about 24 to 48 hours post-injury, when things start kind of stabilizing a little bit better. Oxidative stress is really important because we're starting to see a lot of research coming out from the imbalance of oxidant and antioxidant chemicals within the brain. And why that's important is because of this. All of you have had that patient that comes in that 3-4 days later says, I just don't feel good. Things just aren't working. And a week later they're going, I still don't feel good. And 2 weeks later they still don't feel good. And what the research is showing us is that ongoing, what we'd call the post-concussive syndrome state, is where we're starting to see other things occur, where there's a higher propensity for actual axonal injury, where they've actually done micro-shearing, where we're starting to see plasticity issues. But really important is that inflammatory response during that oxidative, because here's what we often see, is the repeat concussion. Research shows us that about 87% of all secondary concussions happen within the first 2 weeks of the first concussion. And that's because we assume that they're okay, because we'll actually have patients come and say, well, I slept better, I feel better. Okay, well then you must be okay, go about and have fun. But what we're actually finding out is what they think they feel and what their brain feels aren't quite the same thing. And so during this oxidative stress is where we see RTBI, or a repeated traumatic brain injury. Now there's a lot of research, we get asked quite often about CTE, right, because the movie Concussion came out, and everyone's worried that everyone's running around with chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Well, it does happen, the problem is we're not sure if it's actually related to a traumatic brain injury, or if it might have been there to start. There's still a lot of research to be done. We do know that repeated brain injuries definitely increase impairment, definitely cause more damage. But we're seeing probably about 6 months out an increase in amyloid plaques and tau, which are making us believe that there might actually be some connection to the increase of tau and CTE and even Alzheimer's disease now in people that have had multiple concussions without proper recovery. The other thing we look for, and this is kind of where my job comes in, is that I don't usually spend a lot of time trying to figure out if someone's had a concussion. Most primary care physicians, emergency room doctors, pediatricians, all that medical staff are usually pretty good at identifying, did someone get a concussion? The bigger issue happens on when they're not getting better. And what we find out is if we were able to get a strong enough MRI, which we obviously can't immediately, is that there's micro shearing that occurs where they've actually damaged aspects of their axons. And what you see over time is that you see the shearing of that axon, and then later on you start seeing the death. And that can be weeks to months after the injury. And that's why it's so important that we pay attention to that recovery period to make sure that it's not them reporting. What we find, especially, for example, in high school sports, is our favorite one. They come in and say, "You don't understand. If I don't dress next week, I don't play again. I'll lose my spot." And I usually have to have a discussion with them. "You don't understand. If you keep injuring your brain, football's going to be the last problem in your life." So let's talk about concussions really quick. So there's an interesting misnomer that's been occurring not only in the public but in medicine, and that concussions aren't the same as a traumatic brain injury. And that's just not true. What we know is that the concussion is actually that altered mental status that occurs, that change in their functioning post-traumatic brain injury. It's not an issue on if the patient had a traumatic brain injury. They did. They had an injury. It's what happens afterwards that we're concerned about. And the key is that while it's been happening, a concussion isn't unique to only sports. There's sports concussions, but then there's any concussion that actually is associated with that head injury. Now, the new consensus statement just came out, and there's a million things written here about the new stuff we're seeing with sports-related concussions. I might invite you all to get on the British Medical Sports Journal. They actually have, it's just been released. It's open access to anyone that wants to read it. But it's just really, really important to read through, because we've actually come through as an international body and changed some of the rules, and it's affecting the NCAA and the NFL and Major League Soccer and NHL and even community sports. But we're also in the process of taking that consensus and making it stand for all concussions that we're seeing. Here's a symptomology that we try to teach doctors and parents to pay attention to. Obviously, most of us are good at paying attention to the thinking, remembering part, because patients will report that to us. They'll come in and say, "I'm having a hard time concentrating." They'll complain of physical symptoms, headaches, dizziness, balance problems. They may even come in and say, you know, "I'm not as happy," or "I get more irritated." I had a parent the other day say, "Well, how do you tell the difference between a normal ornery teenager and a concussed ornery teenager?" And I was like, I'm not sure, because I've got two teenagers. I'm just trying to survive them right now. But the reality is, are they acting different than they used to? Are things bothering them more? The fourth one is the key one, because almost everyone that comes into my office has never been asked this by anyone medically that they've met with. And that's, are you sleeping correctly? It's not, are you sleeping? It's, are you sleeping correctly? Are you still falling asleep like you need to? Are you waking up refreshed? I'll have patients that come and say, "Oh, I sleep all the time." I'm like, "Awesome. So when you wake up, oh, I feel like garbage when I wake up." Okay, well then you didn't really sleep. Your body went to sleep, but your brain didn't rest. And we know the REM is the only place where the brain is actually healing itself. So if you're not sleeping correctly, you're not repairing correctly. Primary care roles. So obviously when they come in, history is always that key important thing. Tell me what happened. What type of force was it? Where did it occur? You actually have to touch and look. Some patients don't know. I had a young lady in my office 2 days ago that she was actually up in the middle of nowhere, Idaho, at a cheerleading competition. And while her coach went to bed, the 18-year-old assistant took him out in a field and had him practice, and she fell off of a 12-foot tower, landed on her head. But because she didn't get knocked out, everyone said she was fine. So they put her back up there, and she fell a second time. So then she came in, and Aaron's like, "Oh, she only got a concussion." And I said, "Well, how many goose eggs do you have?" "Two." And they're in separate locations. Well, now we've got a bigger issue, because we've got two brain injuries really close together. Well, she is also seeing me because her doctor was perplexed that she had been vomiting nonstop. And it was actually getting to the point where she had blood coming up too. And I looked at her and I said, so what are you doing? Well, my doctor told me to just go home and lay down. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, I'm not allowed to do cheer. So what are you doing? Oh, I'm just doing flips on my trampoline. And I'm like, oh, I think I know why you're not doing so well. So then we got to start adding up. So how many more potential concussions did you have in there? And why aren't you now getting better? And the answer that she got from her doctor was, oh, you're not feeling good? Here's some hydrocodone. It'll make your headache go away. And ironically, it didn't. But most of us already know why. Do's and don'ts. We try to share this especially with our doctors. Number one, we promote sleep. Gone are the days of believing that we need to wake up our concussed individual every 45 minutes to make sure they're still alert. The reality is we know how to go in and say, is their chest moving up and down? Yeah, okay, they're probably okay. Unless originally they were so concussed that they're having a problem staying alert to start with. That's completely different. They probably shouldn't be sitting at home in bed quite yet. They probably should have been seen immediately either in the InstaCare or the emergency room to make sure they were safe to be going home. Once they're cleared, then we want them to rest as much as possible. We promote healthy eating and adequate hydration. I have so many teenagers that come into my office with concussions that go, oh yeah, I drink all the time. I average about 4 Monsters and 8 Gatorades a day. And I'm like, that's not the hydration we're talking about. So the goal in concussions is we want them drinking about 2 to 3 liters of water a day, because the more hydration we have, they seem to do better in recovery. And it's not that we take away hamburgers and stuff from people that are concussed, but we definitely try to get them to eat a little bit healthier so that we can fix that oxidation stressor and get some more antioxidants into their system. We avoid external stimuli. My rule is, if you're not able to go to school, your entire youth program has no business visiting you in your home. You need to be resting. We avoid exertional activity. Now, this is really important. We're going to talk about this in a sec, but what we're finding out in elite athletes is that we can't treat them like your normal run-of-the-mill weekend warriors. Elite athletes, if we don't get them back to doing some type of physical activity, we actually see a significant increase in their depression. So we have to weigh out what was their normal physical activity and how do we try to get them back there as quickly as possible in a safe manner. If we're not seeing progress of any type within 5 to 7 days, really the best thing to do is to refer them to a brain injury specialist, because that usually means that we're looking more axonal injury, and there's different type of techniques that need to be used to hopefully get them back. We limit cell phones. We never thought about this, but I've had to start doing it. We're limiting earbuds and headphones. Of course, I have a teenager daughter that you can hear what she's listening to in our car because it's loud enough, and they don't realize that that may not be good and also be exacerbating their symptoms. And then we screen for mental health. Now, this is really important because the new research is showing us that about 83% of our post-concussive syndrome patients actually don't have neurological impairments. They have mood dysregulation. Now, the other 17% do also have mood dysregulation, but they also have some structural injuries and functional injuries that have occurred also. So one of our key goals is, if we know that they've had a history of PTSD or depression or anything like that prior to their injury, and they're coming in and just not following a normal trajectory to getting better, there's a high chance that their problem is they've dysregulated their mood again, even if it's been years since they've been in therapy or on treatment. And that's something we want to be screening for. Some of the big don'ts. I just realized that apostrophe's in the wrong place. I've been looking at it for 2 days trying to figure out why that word looked funny. Maybe I need to be evaluated. We don't use Zolpidem. We try not to use antihistamines. Obviously, we try not to have them use alcohol. We also try to limit the amount of Tylenol that they're eating. I'll have people come in that they're taking Tylenol every 4 hours or ibuprofen every 4 hours. And usually if they're taking it that often, there's probably something else going on that we need to be doing to try to limit why they're having those headaches. We don't use narcotics for headaches. We don't lock them down. So there used to be that belief that if you had an injury, you go home and you just sleep it off. Go sit in a dark closet in a dark room, don't do anything for a week. The new consensus is 2 to 3 days, we need to have them back to life. Now, we're smart about how we transition that, but we need to get them back to life or we actually see an increase in depression and increase in symptoms. And then the new one, this just came into my office in the last couple weeks, and people have been using ADHD medicine to treat people that are saying they're not focusing really well post-concussion. The research is just barely beginning, and it's looking at individuals with history of PTSD that have come back from war. And we have a lot of patients walk in on a regular basis that the base would send to us that aren't at the VA, that have blast concussions that are PTSD induced, that we need to be putting ADHD medicines in. So what I always share with doctors is if you're concerned about the processing or concentration, have a neuropsychologist take a look at them and make sure it's actually something we want to do. Because if they've actually done axonal damage in that frontal lobe, putting ADHD medicine in there may not be the smartest answer to regulating their mood also. Primary care screeners. So these are the big three that we share with doctors. If they come in your office, you're like, how do I know? What's the best way so that I feel confident? Because I kind of know a little bit, but I don't know a lot. In the ERs, for the ER doctors, the best one is the ACE. It takes about 2 minutes to give, to just go through, and it'll actually tell you at the very bottom, what should you do now? Should you refer? Should you do this? Should you do that? The SCAT-5 and the children's SCAT-5 are actually coming out later on this month, and those take about 5 or 6 minutes to administer. And you can even have your MAs administer these in your office, where they just go through and answer certain things, and it will help you know how are they doing. Now, there's a couple important things. I'll have doctors say, well, I've given them the SCAT-5 like for the last 5 months. The problem is we're seeing that it only works for up to about 5 days, and then because of the onset of post-concussive syndrome, it's not really good at catching all of the features. So again, we want to pay attention to those timelines. Management, like we see, most athletes recover from the physical part in 80 to 90% of them within that first 7 to 10 days. Might see a little bit longer in children, and that's an important part. We used to believe that children somehow recovered faster than adults, and actually children seem to be taking longer than adults to heal. Obviously we want the physical and cognitive rest, but within time frames, like we say, you know, maybe 1, 2, maybe max 3 days, but then we want them back to life. In adolescence, we're starting to see that sometimes the full recovery from concussions can be closer to 4 weeks. That's important because you're going to have those kids in your office saying, I got to get back to football. And they all know that the rule, especially in high school, is if you don't walk through on Thursday, you don't play on Friday. So all of them will feel horrible until Thursday morning, and then we'll get phone calls in our office. Doc, dude, I slept better than I have in like a year. Really? Because I just saw you on Tuesday and you said you couldn't even bend over and tie your shoe. I know, but I slept so much better and I feel, you know, I ate great yesterday and I'm good to go. Awesome. We'll see you next week. We'll find out how you're doing. No, you understand. I'm good now. And I got walkthrough this afternoon. Yeah, I kind of figured you did. And the answer is still no. So treatment protocol. We like to use primary care for immediate diagnosis to follow a very basic concussion protocol. The concussion protocol is really simple. We want you to rest. We want you to drink lots of fluids. Try to eat healthy. Limit what you're doing. And then I want to see you in a week. These are the patients we want to be following up with on a regular basis. Neuroimaging, we put a question mark by it because the truth is the vast majority of individuals that we're doing MRIs on, we have no business doing MRIs on. And we like to do concussions. And the truth is, there's not a really good protocol out there for when we do CTs on concussions. So we want to just kind of pay attention. Most individuals that have had a mild traumatic brain injury don't meet criterion for a CAT scan. And we'll talk about that in just a sec. And then when to refer to a specialist, you know, if they have continued symptoms, 2 to 3 weeks for adults, past 4 weeks for children. If their symptoms are worsening, or if there's a lack of return to learn or return to play within 4 weeks, they need to be referred. And then what we do is we get a little bit more fancy. There's specific neuroimaging that we do. There's special labs we look at for pituitary injuries. We do neuropsych testing and a bunch of other things. Again, really we only use CAT scans or MRIs pre-coming to a specialist if there's a reason to suspicion for some type of structural damage. So if we see the raccoon eyes or the bruising behind the ears, probably a good idea. If they've lost consciousness, a good idea. If they're like, I hit my head and saw stars, probably not a good reason to do a CAT scan immediately. When they come in, we do a lot more screeners to start with. We have the Impact, the King Divic, the Sway. We're in the process of doing research with a company called Headrest, where we're looking at actually pressure in some of the blood vessels through the ear. And then I have a program I use called the C-tip that looks for malingering patterns in people that have sustained a concussion. Obviously, we do a lot more diagnosis and laboratory workup, neuroimaging, and then I take care of more on my part of the management part. What do we got to do medication-wise? What do I need to tell the provider to do for sleep, headache management, mood regulation? Do we need to refer them to PT? I do cognitive rehab. It's very specialized. There's only one or two programs actually that are evidence-based for concussion rehabilitation. And then if we need to, we get them into specialized mental health counseling. Really quick, this was fun, at least for me and my profession, so the new consensus internationally is if someone's had a concussion and it's not getting better in the first week, neuropsychology needs to get involved, because we're actually the specialists that know what the brain should be functioning like. Here's my favorite one. This is one that I share with parents. It's really simple. Number one, if you get a concussion, you've got no business driving for at least 2 or 3 days. If you're coming in saying you feel like poo, you shouldn't be behind a 4,000-pound vehicle flying 70 miles per hour. We're going to wait until you start feeling like you have things back. Then the next one is either you got to return to work or you got to return to learn, or you're not doing anything else. Now, one of the key things, I have a lot of patients come and say, I've got a lot of headaches. Headaches are not a good reason to not go to work or to go to school. There's things we can do to accommodate those, but you still need to be going, because that might actually be a mood dysregulation. Or we may have to send you to a PT or someone else to see if you've done maybe some damage or injured part of your C-spine. But that's not necessarily a good reason to stay home. And then it's a return to play. And we've already talked about the elite versus weekend warrior, how much do we get them back to play and how quickly. Return to learn, these are the things that we try to address with the schools. We've worked really, really hard with the schools to get them to understand these pieces. So if you're going to ask for an accommodation for your kiddo, especially for going back to school, these are the things the school's going to be wanting to see from you. Or don't ask for accommodations, because it'll just cause problems for the kiddo and the families. So testing accommodations, note-taking, workload reduction, breaks, extra time, attendance, follow-ups. We actually have a set form that we use in our clinic that actually explains why that's so important. Because the truth is, even teachers aren't really aware of why it needs to happen. They often see kids, especially this time of year, oh, they're trunky, they don't care, they just don't want to work. This is the return to play protocol. The thing that's only changed in this recently is that we now don't do it by 24-hour periods. So it used to be that you had to have at least a full 24-hour period in each stage before you're able to go back. So as you can see, it goes to stage 6. So it's a whole week of no return to play. We've kind of lessened that now, and we're going based off of symptomology. Now this is fun. If you ever have anyone come in Utah that's a teenager that plays sports, especially in high school, if you don't see this form, you should never release them to go play back a high school sport. Because they actually know, as athletes, they have to have this filled out. And the law actually says we're supposed to be filling this out. Here's the problem that we're seeing in it, is this highlighted piece right here. Doppel, in all their grandness, has come out and said that anyone with pretty much any medical experience that's licensed to some degree can do a concussion screening and sign someone off. Well, here's the problem. Who does that cover medically? A chiropractor? A pharmacist? Your neighbor who works in a care facility? And this is what we're often seeing, is that individuals who don't have a lot of experience with concussions are actually releasing athletes to play without even knowing what they're looking for. And that's where we get these secondary impacts and injuries. So really quick, some myths. Number one, they can sleep. We already talked about that. Number two, this is really big. This is coming up a lot in Davis County, and we've seen it coming from Weber County too. Krill oil does not lower your chance of getting a concussion. We don't know where it has started. There's absolutely no research on it. Now, there is some research coming out about the use of some omega-3s in recovery, but it does not fix you from having a concussion. We're seeing a lot of high school football players coming in telling us that they're doing this. Can imaging diagnose a TBI or concussion? The answer is no. Children bounce back faster than children. Again, don't type at 2 o'clock in the morning. That's actually adults. Play through the pain. We hear that a lot, especially from coaches. That's not a smart move. That's the same as that energy crisis, a heightened chance of getting yourself injured. Again, we talked about the effects of a concussion if they're seen immediately. That they're not disabling permanently, and that's actually not true. If you have axonal injury, it is a permanent injury, and there's things that need to be done. We talked about lock them down, and then the newest one we're hearing a lot of is that helmets have lowered the chance of getting concussions. What the research is showing us is helmets have improved at lowering the chance of fracturing your skull. But right now, there is no research that's showing that there's helmets that are actually lowering the chance of getting a concussion. Now, there are some new helmets that are coming out that they think might work. They're about $1,900 a piece. So I'm pretty sure Northridge High doesn't plan on spending that per athlete. And I'm an alma mater of Weber, and I don't want to get in trouble, but I'm pretty sure they're not going to spend that on their football players either for a helmet. The reality is they're so expensive, and we're not even sure if they're quite doing the job yet. So this is my information. It's been a pleasure to share with you. I know it's a lot of information to cover quickly. You're always welcome to reach out to us. We're here for you. We want to be the go-to to help you guys know how to treat these individuals, because our goal is to get them back to life. I think that's the most important thing that we can do. Is there any questions?
Over here.
Please.
Sorry to be aggravating for those who have to go to the bathroom, but what about these new MIPS helmets for skiing and biking?
They're not improving either. No helmet has shown an improvement of protecting people from concussions.
So that's just for fractures?
All we're seeing it is improve the chance of fracturing your skull, but we're still seeing the same increase of concussions that we're seeing across the board.
Thank you.
No problem. Anyone? Oh, please.
Can you speak to the long-term risk of depression, major depression, in patients that have had concussions?
Okay, so what we're seeing is that when we see that mood dysregulation, if we can get them on a really good mood stabilizer and into specialized CBTI type of stuff, so cognitive behavioral therapy that's more injury-based, that within 3 to 4 months, we usually can get them pretty regulated again. And we're not seeing long-term unless there's actually axonal injuries in that frontal lobe.
There was some confusion in my mind looking at your slides whether you advocate a 5 to 7 day referral if they're not symptom free, there was one slide that said up to 4 weeks.
And that's a great question. So you know, I don't know if there's a perfect catch-all. What I usually share with providers is at 5 to 7 days, if there has been no movement whatsoever, they probably need to go see someone immediately. If we're seeing minor movements, but they're just not getting better, and they're like, okay, so my head doesn't hurt as much, but I can't think as well, we try to take them to that 2 to 3 week as an adult, 4 week as a child. If it worsens, they need to come in, obviously, immediately.
Got it. And how good availability is there for neuropsychology in the area?
There's a couple neuropsychologists. I know them all. Sadly, there's not a lot of brain injury neuropsychologists. My team works really, really hard. We bring in about 30 new patients a week. And so my team tests about 20 people a week. So we're constantly moving them through. So for my clinic, because I only do more medical-based work, even though I do cover some of the other things, we usually can, get, for especially for concussions, our goal is to get them in within 24 to 48 hours.
Wow, that's great. Thanks.
So.
One more question.
Please.
You on one of your slides, you show that wrestling was higher than football for concussions. If you could comment on that. Then also, if you could comment with regard to football for Little League on up through the ranks to NFL.
Okay. So wrestling, you know, I'm not really sure what drives that. I can tell you what my personal experience is, and that's I shattered my thumb in high school doing a cartwheel on a wrestling mat. So part of us are thinking that the fact of them getting thrown around more on the ground, and it's much more of a contact sport without any padding, is what's increasing that threshold of concussions in wrestlers. What we're seeing across the board and from Little League up, I don't know if there's been really good research done on that, because obviously the money's in the NFL and they're in the news, so that's where most of our money comes from. We don't see usually as many severe concussions the younger you are, but we're seeing an increase in the amount of concussions, if that makes sense. So that's that one slide where we're showing that below the age of 19, so these are kids who aren't in college yet usually, that we're seeing an increase in the amount of concussions. I had a dad in my office the other day, his son got hit so hard playing football, his eye actually went sideways. And when I tried to explain to dad, his son couldn't play football, at least for a year till we figure it out. He says, oh, that's not a problem, I'll put him in lacrosse. And I was like, I don't think you get how this actually works. So do I have a personal opinion? So I played football. That my wife may go, oh, now it explains a lot. I'm not anti-football. I'm anti not being trained on how to pay attention to what's going on with patients. The truth is, people can get concussions all over. I mean, we just saw falls have a higher propensity for concussions. Where we're seeing problems is that people aren't paying attention to what happens, so they're not treating it correctly, and then people are getting injured again. What we find is if we can actually get them recovered, the chances drop significantly of getting another concussion. Now, if we know that they start getting a lot of them, I call it a glass jaw phenomenon. If we start noticing that they're getting two or three concussions over a year period, after the second year they're done, I just don't let them play anymore. But most people don't get as severe of a concussion. One of the concerns we have is on the movie Concussion, they showed people killing themselves. And they're like, oh man, if you get a concussion, you're going to get crazy, you're going to shoot yourself. Well, the research shows us that professional athletes, especially football players, are 10 times less likely to kill themselves than the national average of men. So we know that it's not football and head injuries that are causing people to kill themselves. Now, it's not helpful, but that's not the cause of why we see things. We just have a tendency to show the more dramatic side, because if they made my real job into a movie, I would be the lowest grossing movie in the history of the United States. It's not that exciting when you look at stuff like that. But when you put Will Smith and someone in front of it, you got to make it look much more severe than it can be. You know, it's interesting, we often talk that we're concerned that people will overestimate the severity of a concussion because of that movie. What we're actually finding out is people are taking it less serious because they are walking around saying, well, it's Hollywood, so that's not necessarily true. No, you're good. Last question.
Although this may be down the road a bit, could you briefly indicate whether there are any significant improvements now for treatment of very severe TBIs much farther down the road?
So there's a lot of research that's coming out. Sadly, most of that's coming out of Europe currently. Utah, we don't have a lot to offer individuals with regards to long-term severe traumatic brain injuries. There's a lot of research they're looking into, for example, can we put stems in like we're using for Parkinson's and things like that? I don't know if the research has really followed that because there's been so much emphasis put on lately on that mild traumatic brain injuries.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Okay, that concludes our morning session. We've kind of got a quick turnaround because we want to stay on time, so only about 5 minutes. So from the 10 to 12 session, we'll have two options. Right here will be the residents' presentation from our six residents from McKady Family Medicine Residency. And then over here in Ballroom C will be a couple other speakers. One is on future payment models and then medical consumerism. And so you could choose one or the other, and that will go for the next 2 hours. So 5 minute break.